Hello everyone, welcome back. Another episode of The Rut, which I hope you are going to absolutely love. I have another very special episode actually lined up for you this week, but before we go into that, I wanted to just reflect back on the unbelievable episode we released with Simon Thomas last week. I love doing this podcast because every week I get some truly amazing messages from people who tell me that what they listen to on this podcast has had an impact on their lives, and that is literally why I do it. Last week, we had the very defiant Simon Thomas be incredibly open and vulnerable with his remarkable truth, his story of grief, extreme low. Pure devastation, which turned into, I think, quite a heartwarming and hopeful tale of defiance in the face of extreme adversity, and how he rebuilt his and his son Ethan's life. We had countless messages from people saying how touched they were by Simon's honesty and his story, and several people who have experienced the emptiness that grief bestowed on you listen to his story to find hope, inspiration, and also to get a better understanding of how they can deal with their own situation. Now, again, that is what this is all about. This is why we do it. So I'm very sorry for gushing about Simon, but he's a fantastic man, and I can't thank him enough for doing what he did last week. And I really do think it deserves the attention and recognition because it's highly impactful, and grief is something that affects all 7 billion of us on planet Earth. Like I said, I have another very special episode lined up for you on The Rut this week, the podcast which delves into the minds of men from all walks of life to try and answer some of the burning questions about men's mental health. And I probably should have said that at the start of this introduction, but who cares? Some of you might know Damian Brown as a very hard-hitting Irish rugby player, second row, who spent his career in no particular order, playing for Connaught, Leinster, Northampton Saints, Brive and Oyonnax in France. After retiring from rugby, Damian did something very different to, I would say, most professional sports people out there, actually, who retire from sports. Damian wanted to explore what he felt real living was about. How can he live a life which was so close to the core of one's true earth existence? Subsequently, Damian has dedicated his life to being an extreme adventurer. He's run the Marathon du Sable, which for anybody who listened to the Luke Tversky episode we did earlier in this season, it is the marathon which you run 7 days across the 7 marathons across 7 days and over the Sahara Desert. One of his most notable achievements is rowing the Atlantic solo. He set off from the Canary Islands, I believe, and he landed in St. Lucia. It took him 63 days, 6 hours, and 25 minutes. I mean, let that sink in. Solo, across the Atlantic, for 63 days at sea. He has dedicated his life to exploring the ends of the earth, basically. What it feels like to truly live life on the edge of one's existence, and how can you find true happiness, contentment and connection to the soul through being at one with the earth. Damian is also the, I wouldn't say mastermind, but I would say he is also dedicating his life to exploring the boundaries that you can push one's mind to. He is one of the most interesting people I've ever interviewed on this podcast because he's got real in-depth philosophies and techniques about how you can control and train your mind to do anything you want to do. He's got an absolute epic podcast called Deep Roots, which episode by episode, he documents his unbelievable journey, spending 63 days at sea rowing the Atlantic solo. His next challenge, which I think he will probably admit is his toughest one yet, because it's very unique, is rowing the Atlantic with a friend who was never meant to walk again after having a huge accident, leaving him almost paralysed. They want to row the Atlantic together, but doing so on the toughest rowing pathway possible, venturing southerly instead of going north over the Atlantic, where if you go southerly, you compete against the brutal South Atlantic swells and tides. It is the true test of mind-body experience and existence. I will put all the links to Damien's website, his Instagram page, his podcast, and more in the show notes below, so please do explore away. He is a world-class operator. So I am very, very excited to welcome Damien Brown this week. This podcast explores his mindset and how you can overcome any challenges that is put in front of you. It is fucking powerful. So, Damien, welcome to the rut. As always, please leave all judgment at the door. Damien Brown, welcome to the rut. How are you?
I'm very well, James. Thanks for having me on the rut. Appreciate the invitation.
No, the honour's mine. I've followed you as a rugby Norse. I've followed you throughout your rugby career, from the deep dark depths of Galway over to Leinster, and then over to France. Some career.
Well, it was a journey in itself. You know, I think it was. My career was a reflection of who I am, you know. So it was quite curious. I played for 5 different clubs, but I only moved from one. I was only kind of forced to move from one of them. The others were all choices that I wanted to move and explore different leagues, different countries, if you want, to a lesser extent. And it was an incredibly fruitful journey. I would not be the person I am without rugby. It forged me in many, many ways. Some of them I'm not even conscious of. An incredible sport. And, you know, I am so grateful that I walked in the gate of Galwegians RFC as an 11-year-old and continued to walk in it. I was passing by it the other day, and they're actually trying to sell Galwegians RFC the ground, you know. And I was looking in going, geez, imagine that wasn't there. Where would my life be? What would it have been if that hadn't been within a stone's throw of my house and all the other local lads weren't going up on a Saturday morning to play in the minis?
What do you think your life would have been?
Oh God, I shudder to even think. You know, because so much of who I am has been discovered in extremes, and rugby and the environments of pro rugby are incredible extremes. Like, there's just they demand so much of you, and that brings a part of you you don't even know exists out. So if I hadn't have had rugby, I'm going to say I would have never touched those extremes. I would have never got to those edges of life that sport forces out of you. And obviously I knew from the start, I literally knew from that first training session that, you know, rugby was something I wanted to do. I remember the moment. I remember the part of the pitch where I let go, like, into a tackle to make a tackle. As I'm only 11 years old now, so don't, you know, don't be romanticizing this picture too much in your minds when I talk you through it. But I let go, I went to tackle a guy who was running past me with the ball, and I fell off the tackle, and as my kind of head kind of came down his legs, I got the trail of his boot up into my chin. And I remember that moment so vividly. Like, I remember the feeling going, yes, this is for you. Like, I just loved everything about that. Like, firstly, letting go, you know, forgetting about everything and just throwing yourself fully into the tackle. And then the physicality and the nearly the vibrations of the kind of physicality through my body. And it just like was a very positive kind of feeling, very positive feedback. And then I knew that that was something I was incredibly passionate about for that moment. And that passion, you know, was really important for me to touch all those extremes that I talked about in the game.
Well, that's you. That's you. That's you at 11 years old, right?
Mm.
And it sounds like to me that you, from the age of 11, were incredibly in touch with... I'd say incredibly in touch. For an 11-year-old, you were very in touch with being aware of yourself, your presence. Because getting a stray boot, I've had it myself. It fucking hurts. It's a pain that is sometimes pleasurable, sometimes not. But it does make you feel alive when you go through that pain. Mm. Before you stepped on a rugby pitch, were you that in touch with who you were and your kind of, and this energy around you, this positive energy that runs through you?
You know, it's just a really strong memory, and I don't have a huge amount of memories from my younger days, you know, but that's just one on reflection when I think about, like, because I think about this all the time, like, what makes me me? Like, where have I come from? What has forged me? And when I look back right to the start, like, that's a huge, that's a very clear, vivid memory that pops up. And, you know, obviously there was a little game of rugby, and there was another, I guess there was another 20 minutes of it. And I just remember that split second, you know, or that 2 or 3 seconds that it took me, and it just sticks out when I ask myself that question, you know, like, well, what, where have I come from? How have I got to where I am? And, you know, I ask those questions because I want to keep developing and I want to keep growing and improving, and I want to kind of share what has made me me, because I feel it, like, without sounding self-absorbed or self-righteous, but I feel like I've learned so much in my journey, and it's given me so much in terms of kind of my inner peace that, you know, if I can share that with people, it's a very dutiful thing to do. So that's why I kind of go back and reflect from time to time, try and figure out why and where I've come from and how I've been developed.
In my research for the podcast, I'm very well prepared because I like exploring lots of different areas, right? And I was listening to a podcast you did with somebody else. And you said that there was a moment when you were 17 years old, slightly lanky but fat, chubby 17-year-old on a very muddy pitch in Galway. And you made a very profound decision on your future and how you want to live your life, this type of mindset you had. Can you take me back to that moment? And, like, what was the decision you consciously made and why?
The conscious decision was simply to get fit. I was not fit. I was enormous for, like, I was bigger then than I am now. Like, I weighed more anyway. And I was only 17 or 18. So, and I, you know, I could tell that I had a little bit about me in rugby. Like, I had aggression and I had a bit of skill because I always had a rugby ball in my hand, but I just couldn't last anywhere near, you know, in the game. I'd come out of it into it and I'd grab the ball and I'd run over a few people and then I'd be out of it, you know. So I got dropped, I think, I did make my school's team in fifth year, which is in the second last year of school, you know. And then it hurt a lot. Like, you know, it was very, because of how important it is. If you remember schools rugby, like, it's just, it's such a, it's way more important than education. You become
rugby,
obsessed.
Rugby and women, yeah.
Yeah. And like all your mates, all my long-term friends are guys from that team now. Like, you know, it's just, it really is a formative part of your life, and rugby plays a huge role in it with its importance. So it just hurt a lot not making that team. And I just, the pain of that happening again, you know, when I asked myself the right questions was really strong. Like it was they were, those questions were inducing painful answers, and I just off that energy that the pain gave me, I just made a decision to get fit. I didn't know what that looked like. This was 1997, and all I knew was, I see people running around pitches, I'm going to go up to Go Agents and just going to run around the pitch. I was so unfit the first night that I lasted like 2.5 laps. But I went back the next night and the next night and the next night and the next night. And it was just through that. I could see myself obviously improving. You know, I was getting a little bit more, an extra lap every night or so. And for 30 nights straight, I went up, I think. And and by the end of it, I was, you know, running 20 odd laps and just plodding along. But I was building, I always say I was building an association between the struggle, between the action that was hard and the reward. And I went basically from 17 not making my senior rugby team to 19 being a professional rugby player. So
you play for presumably Connacht.
Yeah, basically got a contract with Connacht at 19 and then played there for 5 years.
And then moved over to Dublin?
No, I actually moved to the UK then after that. Northampton Saints, yeah. Had great 4 years there, so moved there quite young, like 24 or so. And played there for 4 seasons. Loved it. Just a proper rugby club, rugby town, yeah. rugby mad. Fantastic setup. Okay, the club wasn't in a great place on the pitch when I was there. We struggled a little bit. But, you know, I got to play with great players and just got to play in a club that, like, has such an incredible history and tradition, which is a little bit different to Connacht in terms of its, I suppose, its foothold in the local town and its importance. You know, it was just everybody was Saints mad. So that was great. That was a great experience. I moved out then. I moved out to France after that. Played in Brive for 3 years. Another amazing part of my life. Look on it. Have really fond memories of living in France. Really fond memories of the top 14. And Brive in particular as a town, really nice people. I just loved the shock of the culture and learning the new language and seeing how people kind of went about their daily lives out there. And it's a real quiet part of France. The Crest is the department that's where Brive is based. It's just really like kind of hidden away, quiet, sleepy part of the French countryside, which was something that I learned to love, and it's really appealing now. I'd love to actually at some point in my life kind of spend some more time out there. The 3 years there, and then again the club was in a bit of a state on the pitch. We had some mad coaches. Mental. The French.
Who are your coaches? Rugby.
So I started with a guy called Laurent Sten, who is a real old school French prop. He didn't do much coaching, but he was kind of over the team. He'd do a bit of scrummage and stuff, crazy stuff. Nobody's blinking an eye if you did 50 live scrums in France, like on a Tuesday. Whereas nowadays, if you said that to a professional team, they'd be like, what? No, we're not doing that. Yeah, just mental stuff. Like, you know, the French league is all about survival of the fittest, and there's no real.
It's also about survival of the biggest as well, isn't it? From everything that's been said, the anecdotal like stories is right. Okay, well, there's really a lack, or there was a lack of emphasis on nutrition, and I suppose everything that you associate with the professional game now. So walking in on in the morning and having croissants and jam before you do a big training session, it's like, wow, okay, this is golf in class.
Yeah. They're so far behind in terms of strength and conditioning and just habits, good habits that lead to good rugby players, you know. They just have amazing talent in the country, and that's how they kind of survive, you know. And they're getting left behind a little bit every year because, you know, you just can't compete with teams who are incredibly fit and organized and on that talent, you know. It's gone past that now. It was grand in the 90s and even the early 2000s where, you know, you could be better than them because they weren't at a level of fitness, but now they're just, you know, you're dealing with machines. They really have to make some big changes sooner or later. And I love the way they actually put, the French are so fucking dissolute. They're so, what's the word I'm looking for? The French rugby circles, they're so abused in what they think is their problem. Like, they think they have too much foreigners in the league, but that's the least of their worries. Their worries is all off. It's all about the processes that they put in place. They're really far behind, like, in terms of that sort of stuff, and they're getting further and further left behind, further and further. Like, but anyway, it was at the same time, it was so batshit crazy. It was a lot of fun at times. And I was quite glad I was like 28 to 31. I was kind of, you know, I was well into my rugby career. If you're going there at 22, 23, 24, it's not the place to be, like, you know, because they don't ingrain. Like, I had good habits and I was a good professional and I really prided myself on my standards. So I was able to lead myself and regulate myself. But, you know,
did you find that difficult?
No, it's just the way I've always been, that way kind of wired, you know, nearly since that day when I was 17 and I made that decision and I started to run, you know, I've just always been very kind of taking ownership of my own life. What I found difficult is the pushback against that, you know. So if I'm in the gym on a day off and I'm in the gym and I'm training and I'm doing my bit to be better on a Sunday and I'm getting shit off the coach, I'm like, are you fucking mental, man? I'm not doing this because I want to look good. I'm doing this to be a better rugby player, like, and you're giving me shit, like, you know. You and then I have to come in and train with these shit bags that are giving me nothing, like fatty over there in the corner who's eating six plates of pasta and a load of cheese before he goes training. I'm going, sort him out. Give him shit. Don't be giving me shit for training, like, you know. Yeah.
Go on.
Go ahead.
I was going to say
it can't be that bad because I ended up going back to France after moved to Leinster 2 years later. So, yeah, it can't have been that bad.
Was there any throughout your rugby career, obviously you've played five to six different teams, England, Ireland, France. When rugby players get to the end of their career, generally speaking, they start to think, what's next? At what stage in your rugby career, if at all, did you sit there or stand there and be like, okay, I'm going to do something very, very, very different, and that's okay? Like, had you had any sort of inkling that what you're doing now was going to be your pathway during rugby?
It was a bit of a slow burner. I knew I wanted to. So basically, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew what I was going to do in terms of, I knew I was going to run the mark in the Sable. I knew I was going to attempt to row across the Atlantic. these were things I had discovered during my rugby career, and you know, by just basically researching how what other people were doing in their kind of lives to push themselves. And you know, I became a little bit fascinated by what people were doing and what I could take from those people to be a better rugby player. So, you know, that stemmed from everything from people running the Mountain de Sable, people rowing the Atlantic, to, you know, what bodybuilders were doing in their training and how they were getting better, or what other athletes were doing, you know. So it was quite a broad range of stuff, and it was just simply looking for ways to get better. So basically, saw a documentary on the Mountain de Sable. I was only about 22 or 23, and I was like, right, I'm going to do that someday. Read a book about from two British guys, James Cracknell, ex-Olympian, three-time Olympic champion, and Ben Fogle, TV presenter, you probably know him. Both of them rode the Atlantic as a pair in 2005, and I read the book the next year called The Crossing, and I was like, yeah, that's a bit of me, I'm going to do that at some point. So it was just a case of picking up these things, you know, and then it was like rugby was just so important. I think you can probably tell by what I'm saying, like, that I was incredibly driven to be better. So it was like, right, once rugby's finished, then I will look at kind of doing these things or attacking these things. And you know, I just knew I wanted to do them for my own life, for my own growth, for my own development. I knew they would push me, and there was nothing about them that didn't appeal. I loved everything, the extremes, the adventure, the challenge, like, you know, it's just, yeah, bring it on. So it just ticked a lot. It pulled me in its kind of how much it, I suppose it resonated inside me, you know, to try them. I planned for that then, you know. I knew that, like, I was going to finish rugby, and obviously the money was going to stop. So I just started saving for about 7 years. I think it was about 7 years before, and I just started saving money, just thinking that, like, you know, well, rugby's going to finish at some point, so you might as well have a little bit of a nest egg just to, if you do want to explore these things, because I don't think anyone's going to pay you to do them, which turned out to be the case.
No, it's that, it's a very interesting, I suppose, the psychology of it's very, very interesting, because you've made a decision incredibly early, and yet you were still playing rugby. How was your body post, like, or through playing rugby? Because your body's taken a battering through playing professional rugby for God knows how long, and then you've stepped into another career, which is arguably takes even more of a toll on your body.
Yeah, well, pro rugby is it's just an abattoir. Like, it just eats you up and spits you out, you know. It's incredibly stressful in many ways, emotionally, mentally, and physically. It all starts with the physical stress, you know, and there's demands placed on you that are a little bit unfair from time to time, but that's just how those machines function, the rugby environments, you know. I'm somebody who is good at one thing, and that's enduring. So I was able to endure those environments. That's not to say they didn't have huge detrimental effects on my body, which they did, you know, and even my own, I worked against myself as well. My own endurance and my own will actually, you know, would have compromised me physically over the years, and particularly towards the end, you know. Now, I did become much more conscious of mistakes I would have made along the way, and I would have been almost firefighting some of them towards the end, just trying to hang on, but it wasn't to be, you know. And I kind of got spat out at the end of my 16th season. Now, I was in a place where I was tired mentally. I was tired fighting the rugby environments and fighting myself, you know. So I stepped away and just took like 6 months to regenerate some love for kind of Everton, you know, and just some energy.
What did you do in those 6 months?
I traveled for 3 months into, first thing I did actually was climb Mont Blanc and Grand Paradiso up in the Alps, because I was living in a place called Oyonnax in the eastern France. So it was only about an hour and a half from Chamonix. So it was kind of there, literally kind of looking down on me. So I was like, well, that's something I'm going to do when I retire. I'm not leaving here without attempting that. I didn't actually so much because we got blown off, but we summited on Grand Paradiso, which is in Italy. So that was the first thing I did. And then I traveled into Central Asia. So I went to Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan actually for like, 2 months or so. So I spent a bit of time on the road, and then I came back here to Ireland. And then I started to get ready for the Marathon des Sables. So I was about 6.5-7 months from the start of that, I started training. And that was doing, so I'd lost a lot of weight. I finished with a knee injury. So I'd given that a bit of time to heal. And literally the first training session I did for the Marathon des Sables was I couldn't run without pain. That was stopping me playing rugby. I had no cartilage in my knees, or basically hardly any cartilage in either knee. So one of them was just, for whatever reason at the time, it just wouldn't come good in my last season. It was very painful to run on, and it ended up retiring me. But when I got back to training for the MDS, there was still this big question mark, is your knee going to be okay? But because I'd lost some weight, and because I hadn't been jumping and running and getting smashed in rugby for 6 months, actually felt good. Now, the first training session was only a few strides, 25-meter strides, but, 7 months later, I crossed 257 kilometers of the Sahara Desert. I wouldn't say I ran it, but I got across it. So, there was, and since that, I've had to put an enormous amount of time and energy and emphasis on trying to regather some of and trying to refine some of my capacities as a human that rugby would have taken away from me, So while continue to train hard and push on and become better at what I'm trying to train for, be it rowing or mountaineering or running or whatever.
And for people who don't know, the Marathon des Sables is 7 marathons in 7 days across the Sahara Desert, which I would probably argue 99% of the world's population don't look at that. We'll probably look at that and think, I'm never ever, what the hell is people doing running 7 marathons in 7 days across the Sahara Desert? But you're not that one. You're not in that 99%. You're definitely in that 1%.
Yeah.
Where do you start with the training for that?
Depends on your profile. So you would train differently to me, and it also depends on who would train differently to my neighbor, who would train differently to somebody else. And it also depends on your ambitions. I think those two things need to be taken into consideration. So like for me, obviously being 6'5", 120 at that stage, 4 or 5 kilos. Coming out of the back of a rugby career, having been, trashed basically, and having a lot of knee issues, not in the knee issues, but knee issues, yeah, but more like just kind of heavy wear and tear through my knees, If I went down the classic ultramarathon route, which could suit somebody else, but for me, it would just absolutely destroy me. If I'm trying to get to the start line in peak condition, that is not the route for me to do that. So you just have to be careful, and you have to program, or I anyway had to be careful at how I programmed my training, and my ambition was just to finish it. It was not to compete on any level. I didn't give a fuck where I finished basically. Yeah. So that also plays a role, because if I wanted to compete, I would have to do the mileage. I would really have to. I have no choice. I would have to do the disgusting miles, because there's no way I'm competing otherwise, right? Whereas I didn't care about competing, I just cared about finishing it. So that was a different element to programming for me that it might have been for other people who were there.
Can I take you back to the start line of the Marathon des Sables?
Sure.
And if we go back there and visualize, you're stood on, how hot is it at that stage?
I would say it was somewhere in the high 30s. I think the hottest it got to was on day four. There was people saying we had about 45, and that's not a hot year out there. Like for them, it wasn't a particularly hot year. Yeah. But yeah, let's say high 30s, somewhere like that.
So we stood on the start line. You was a 6'5". You would have lost a bit of weight by since then. So probably maybe 110 kilos. I don't know. Around about that.
117.
Like that, yeah. You're a big guy running across the desert. Take me back to the start line of what was running through your mind.
Well, they play Highway to Hell on the start of your race. They blare it out and they make a kind of big. The guy who runs the race is Patrick Bauer is his name, and he was the first guy who, he went to the Sahara over 12 days and basically crossed whatever 400 kilometers over or something. So then he came back the next year and he developed a race, and there was 12 people. So he's still running it. So he does a big kind of hype, if you want, to the whole crowd with a bit of AC/DC going on. But I'll tell you what. What comes up for me when you say that is just, I always find that when you've worked really hard and you've kind of dreamt something has been really important to you, you know, I found out about this 13 years before I actually did it. So it was there in the back of my mind from time to time. It would pop up and you go, yeah, I'm going to do that someday. And then you put in 7 months of training and, you know, you strive for it. And then it all, that's the moment where, for me, a lot of emotion flows out of me, you know. So I did get a little bit teary-eyed. I did get in a really good way, in a very happy way, you know. Nobody but you knows the work you put in to get there. Like, nobody saw me flogging around the pitches in the middle of December when it was pitch black. You know, nobody could feel what I was going through. Nobody could feel when I was doing my interval training in the middle of February in a small gym in Galway, that, you know, that those fights that I was going through, those quits. So like, only you know in that moment what you put in to get there. And I always find that's a very kind of powerful moment, you know. I always get a little bit emotional, as I did with at the start of the MDS.
Before we started recording the podcast, I was talking to you about a friend of mine, Luke Tversky, who has also run the Marathon des Sables, and he was describing how we spoke at length about the Marathon des Sables when we recorded, and he said that there was a number of different points where he obviously wanted to give up, but also where he was in one of the most brutally physical ruts that he's ever he can imagine being in. I think it was day four he was hallucinating and had to be put on an IV drip, and then most people with 60k to go post IV drip would have probably chucked in the towel, but he ripped out the IV drip and carried on running. Are there similar points of that for you, like of that journey, where you were thinking in your mind, like, what am I doing? Or were there moments where it was so, so brutal that you were having this argument in your mind, like, you are insane?
I love these adventures or these challenges. Like, and when I'm in them, my self-talk is, you're not getting negative here. You want this. You trained for this. You fucking love this. And it's just, I find it's a thing called first level thinking, in that, like, your mind is trying to find a way out. It is bringing up what's negative. It is bringing up what it knows, the excuses and the justifications. It knows the buttons to press with you. And it's just about getting been aware of that and then just getting past it with a different
narrative. Why do you think it brings up those questions?
Because the stress, it doesn't want stress. Your mind and your body wants comfort. It is wired to want that first and foremost, and it'll do anything in its power to bring you back to a comfortable place. And that's why self-awareness is incredibly important in any of these endeavors, because you have to be aware of that narrative, that fight inside, you know, because the first place we'll always go is, you know, once things get stressful, it'll be, how do I make this subconsciously? How do I make this back to comfort? How do I make the stress stop? And it'll do anything in its power. So I, even during the MDS, even though it was fucking hard, like parts of your body were hurting, I found my lower back in particular. It was just about resetting my mind. And I've become really efficient or proficient at doing that. You know, it never changes. It doesn't matter. As long as you're challenging yourself, you will get those states of weakness, of negativity. You just become better at processing them and faster at recognizing them and overcoming them with the tools at your disposal.
You said resetting mentally, what's the process that you had to go through? Assuming really every single morning, probably it was waking up and your body's in bits and you're sweating your balls off and it's just like, Christ, another day of this. Because as you say, subconsciously, our first reaction is stop putting me through the pain. But was it waking up in the morning, having to reset mentally? How do you do that?
So it wasn't so much the morning. I found what I prepared for mentally anyway was, with the MDS, was more the grind during the day, you know, the moments where during the day, during the work, during those long stages where you do, you know, naturally you just become a little bit negative or a little bit outcome orientated and you feel a bit heavy mentally. The process I had in place for the MDS, something I've kind of moved away from now, but one then was a thing called the cut process. So you need to cut the negative self-talk. You need to be aware of it first and foremost, then you need to cut it. And I had a mantra or just a sentence or a saying that was incredibly blunt that I would say to myself to cut that negative talk. If you want, I can say it. It was, stop being a see you next Tuesday. Okay. And then
honestly, swear as much as stop being a cunt is great.
Stop being a cunt, whatever, stop being a pussy, you know, that would just cut the negative self-talk. And then it was just about reaffirming it with some positive self-talk and some positive imagery, some positive emotions through that imagery, you know. So, and then with a positive mantra to go with that, so, or an affirmation or something. And that worked well for me, you know. I think you just need the first and foremost is, you know, the reason I say I've gone away from it now, because I would be more inclined to self-awareness of obviously your state, but then I would revert to I call them controllables. There's four things I find that can be controlled in by me in those moments that always put me in a neutralized state and get me away from the negative, or get me away from the outcome orientation, or get me away from what I can't control. So that's where I'm a little bit at that now. That's not to be said that cut process can't be used, but I find it's where it's most beneficial is in the darkest moments. You know, I don't think it needs to be constantly employed. But it can be and will be and is very useful and very something you should I can always have in my deck of tools when shit gets really, really, really bad.
I want to get onto that in a sec, actually, because with the first Atlantic row. But what was the hardest moment across those 7 days? I want to picture it.
So night. So it's a hard picture. But a night on the day four, the long stage, that your guest, James, what did you call him? James, was it? Sorry.
Luke.
Luke, excuse me. That Luke talked about, the double marathon stage, which was my year, was exact double marathon, 52.4 miles or 84.4 kilometers. Yeah. So that was the night of that on flat, soft sands. So not been able to see any further than your head torch, not really been able, you know, if you're for your head torch at a certain angle, it doesn't project down to the sand you're actually putting your eyes on and where you're trying to put your feet. Mm-hmm. And then trying to, that means that you're constantly missing or not getting a perfect step, or your foot isn't hitting the ground exactly as you would like it. And then trying to obviously push away in soft sand, you don't get any force production. You're like, you wheel spin, you know, your feet wheel spin out of it, and you can't, if you're not, you know, if you're just walking down the road, obviously you push out of your foot, but here you've only got like a quarter of an inch before your foot goes. And you do that for hours without being able to see fuck all. It does your head in. I tell you, it absolutely does your head in. Yeah, so that was the moment my nemesis was flat, soft sand at night. It was just head-wrecking. You know, and it's just the consistency of the head-wreck that really kind of breaks your resolve or chips away at your resolve.
Mm. You finish the Marathon des Sables, you cross that finish line, I imagine unbelievably exhausted. What's that moment like?
So there's six stages, and the sixth stage is a charity stage. That's the official finish line. Really, the finish line is the end of day five, because everybody, even the top guys, even the guys who have the Moroccan guys who like just piss through this thing, it's absolutely phenomenal to witness. Like, I mean, they're just, it's ridiculous the speeds they drew. I think that this, I forget the guy's name now. Shame on me, really. But the guy who won it, he's won it a load of times in a row at this stage, a Moroccan guy. And his average speed was 12.1 kilometers an hour. It's absolutely mind-blowing when you think about it. Over the course of 257 kilometers, through mountains, through sand, through lunar landscapes. So it's just, anyway, even these guys walk the last stage, you know. So the last stage is normally anywhere between 7 and 17 kilometers. So it's kind of over before it's over. It's over at the end of day five. And that is very similar to what I talked about earlier. It's like, again, it's personally, it's a very emotional kind of place I found myself in. I remember in the NDS, I don't know if Luke said the same thing, but I found that they completely try and mindfuck you where they put the ends and the checkpoints. So they'll either put them where you can't see them, and they like, you come over the brow of a hill and they're finally there. So you've come over a load of fucking dunes or something, and you're like, is it this one? No. Is it the next one? No. Is it the next one? No. Is it this one? Yes, finally. Or they put it way in the distance on a flat, on a horizon, on a flat piece, and it seems like it is never getting closer. So I remember on the day, end of day five, which was a full marathon, I came over this dune, and there it was finally, and that's when I got this kind of burst of emotion, you know, that I felt like I'd done it. As far as I was concerned, I had finished the Marathon des Sables, and I'd been thinking about completing it for, like I said, about 13 years. So it was, I can still see it quite clearly, the checkpoint and where it was set and coming over that dune. It was lovely moment.
Unbelievable. In between what we're going to talk about now, or I hope we will, you summited Everest, right?
No, I wish. Jeez, I was meant to give Everest a go. I was meant to attempt to summit it April and May just gone there.
Right.
But obviously COVID put to that. So I'm going to attempt Everest in April now next year. So about six okay. months from now, yeah.
So post Marathon de Sable and before the Atlantic Row, there was a number of challenges there, wasn't there?
I'm just trying to think now. So I did the MDS in 2016 and I did the Atlantic Road I started at the end of 2017. So I would have done a little bit of stuff, but nothing. It's only nothing too major. I've only really got into the seven summits after the Atlantic Row. So over the last couple of years, I've been taking on them. But there was nothing major in between those, because it took me to prepare for the Atlantic Row, took me 19 months, you know. So there was a lot of work going in there in kind of the quiet time, if you want, between adventures. Mm.
Mm. Why rowing?
So when I was at Northampton, we used to do offy conditioning on the ergometer. Mm. Especially the bigger guys, they were a little bit ahead of their time there, and that they wanted to kind of keep guys off the pounding of the joints, pounding on their joints from, you know, we're obviously running. So we used to do a lot of work on that, and we used to do a fitness test on it actually as well. It started the preseason and end of preseason, they had this manky fitness test on it. I can't really remember now, but it was all about power endurance. So it was like, I don't know, you did like 150 meters, very little rest, 150 meters, 250 meters, 250 meters, all like only minimal rest in between, like 30 seconds. Then there was a 500 meter and then there was a 150 to finish. And it was proper one of those bandy leg things when you came off, you know, you'd walk in and they had about six ergs, you know, or eight ergs, and the last group are just come off their test and there's just people like trying to walk around the gym and like lads getting sick out windows and you're like, oh man, here we go. But it turns out I was pretty good on it. I mean, nobody could touch me on the erg.
Really?
I was just like, I had a lot of power and obviously a lot of leverage. So I used to do a lot of my own kind of work then. I kind of grew a love-hate relationship with the erg, like, and I used to do a lot of my own just little bits and pieces. If I was ever coming in to just get a sweat on or get a blow on or do some condition work, I'd always pick the erg. And I realized the mental benefits are extraordinary from that machine, because like every stroke is measured. You get instant feedback on your effort, and it can be the longest place in the world mentally to spend some time on, but it also can be incredibly insightful in what your mind does. And you know, if you get through a really tough session, you're walking on cloud nine. I mean, nothing can touch you for the rest of the day off the erg. So you know, that I suppose relationship just grew and grew and grew. And then when I got out of rugby, I compete on the ergs, you know, so, I compete on in like indoor rowing events. I'm still pretty good at it. I love it. I absolutely love it. Like, I mean, I just, the mental benefits for me are extraordinary. Mm. Like, I just think it's just, it's a different level of beast mentally rowing. So, and that's what I'm really interested in, you know, discovering more about myself in that area, and that machine gives it to me. And then there's just something, when I read that book about, from Cracknell and Fogel, and just thinking about like everything about the adventure of rowing across an ocean was like, it's what a fucking thing to do with your life, is what I used to say to me, say to myself. So I went and did it. Simple as that.
Mm. No, 19 months training for anything is a fucking long time. And then to row single-handedly 4,800 kilometers across the Atlantic Ocean is unbelievable. I've been listening to your podcast, which is an extraordinary insight. I'm only on episode 3, which how long are you doing that podcast for as well? Have you got any, how many episodes you got planned?
I think it looks like I've recorded 11 myself. It looks like there'll be about 25 or 26 for the whole story. Wow. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Cause I've got like video. So I took these video kind of diaries. So I've got like 57 or 8 days of them, you know, and it took me 63 days. So, and there's so much to the story. I remember when I was going through it going this, like, I mean, at the end, it was only closer to the end of it, like in the 50s and 60s, I started taking much kind of longer video diaries because I was like, man, there's a book in this. Like, I mean, you need to be you. It was almost regrettable that I wasn't doing it from the start. But listen, we live and learn, right? But just because I went through so much out there, because I'm quite, those video diaries were quite orientated towards the mental side, and I was just been trying to be very honest and kind of open about, you know, the stresses I was going through and how I was kind of overcoming them or not, how I was falling down around them, because I just think, I don't know, there's something about that I think that people can take something from, I hope so anyway, some value, because it doesn't get much more stressful than that, you know. So I'm hoping it looks like there's going to be about 25 or 6, I'd say, in this series.
You were out on the water for 63 days, 6 hours and 25 minutes, right? And it's actually a race, isn't it? How many other people were doing it at the same time?
There was 25 boats, and there was 5 solos, and 3 of us finished. So
3 solos or 3 people?
Sorry, no, 3 solos finished of the 5. Excuse me. There was about, I think, 4 boats didn't get across. It was particularly, what would you say, a big year in terms of weather. So we got a lot of following storms and big seas, and it was a bit sketchy, and there was 4 boats didn't make it through that, and that there was 2 of them had to be rescued and 2 of them had to be pulled back into the island we started at, La Gomera, and then 3 of us solos finished. So yeah, it was mostly people doing it in 4-man boats, some people and pairs, but there's only a few who will actually have the kahunas to go out on their own, really.
Day 1 was pretty crazy, right? You've gone out there, and I think you left the harbour, and as I can see it or hear it in your podcast and having watched some of what you've produced, it was like this realisation of what the fuck you're about to do has kind of hit you, because the weather and the wind picked up. I was kind of thinking, what where do I even start with this?
Yeah, it's kind of what I was thinking at the time. Yeah. What the fuck is going on? I had no idea. I mean, it was like getting a punch off Mike Tyson, I imagine, in terms of its unexpectedness. I just, you know, I had prepared for, mentally, again, I'd gone through a lot of preparation in my training. I had foreseen, obviously, huge mental hurdles. I'd foreseen storms. I'd foreseen how I might deal with them, but I didn't think it was going to happen on day 1. I didn't think I was going to get blown backwards on day 1. I didn't think, you know, my body, the thing that, you know, my whole adult life has been revolved around it, you know, trying to get more out of it, that was, and the thing I could always rely on was just going to shut down on me. I was like, so when all those things happened at once, I mean confusion is an understatement. I was like, I didn't know what was happening. I was, didn't know my arse from my elbow. I was incredibly destructive. And
how far out of the bay were you? Like, what are we talking about here?
I'm going to say 25 miles, 30 miles, that's all.
Offshore.
I mean, you can still see the islands. You can still see, so Tenerife is beside La Gomera and it has a big, huge mountain on it called El Teje. You can still see El Teje and you could still see El Hierro, which is the last Canary Island, the smallest one. I hadn't even got past that. I hadn't even got anywhere near getting past that. So I was like, yeah. I might as well have still been able to see my parents waving goodbye to me. Like, you know, I was like, yeah, it's completely unexpected.
And you're hit by this gust of wind and you're blown back. Like, how heavy is the boat? That's when I've listened to your stuff, I've always been asking myself, like, actually, what does it take to row a boat like what you were rowing? Because it's not just a gem for people who haven't seen it, and I'm hoping people after this conversation or during this conversation will actually Google what it is, but it's not just a normal rowing boat. It's a boat in which you are able to sleep, albeit very uncomfortably, but live a very solace life, but like it's quite a big thing. Yeah. To row.
Yeah, it's 7 meters long. At its widest point, it's about 2 meters wide on the open rowing deck. And then it has two cabins either end. One of them is for storage and the other one you basically live in and you do everything in. All your electrics are in there, your water maker, your radios, your bed, your GPS. And that's your sanctuary. It weighs, I think when it was fully loaded, which is the first day you obviously leave, that's when you have the most amount of food and everything. It's about 750 kilos, maybe a little bit less. But it moves well in the water, like, you know, so it doesn't feel like you're rowing 750 kilos, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
What does it feel like you're rowing?
It's surprising how well it moves through the water, I suppose, is the best way I can put it. I don't know how to compare it to, if I was to put a weight on it, you know, it feels heaviest when you're rowing into a headwind in kind of, I'm going to say 10 to 15 knot wind. So that's not going to really help anyone, I suppose, in imagining how hard it is to move it. But if I think about the Atlantic crossing, the actual boat is as hardest to move on the flattest day. When the water is really flat, that's the day it's hardest to move. I saw that as an opportunity for me, believe it or not. I was like, well, I don't think anyone in this race can row as well as I can. So I actually didn't mind conditions like that. But you hear people saying it's like rowing through treacle. You know, but, you know, that's, I suppose, subjective to us all. Like, and I didn't feel like that. I felt like it worked in my favor in those days, but there wasn't many of them. There really wasn't. So, and like Everton, I have Everton on board that boat that I need to survive for the whole.
What was your food? Crossing. What food did you take?
So I had 90 days worth of food because I had no idea how long I was going to be out there. And about 6,500 calories of food a day. And that was split in between 3,500 calories of freeze-dried or dehydrated rations and then 3,000 calories of snacks. And like the snacks could have been anything from protein bars, protein powder. I brought some carb powder. So every morning I'd have a shake. First thing I'd have is like something with some protein, a bit of creatine, and some dextrose and multidextrin, you know, so some quick release carbohydrates. And then I had other snacks like flapjacks, biltong, nuts, seeds, all nut butters, you know, almond butter, cashew butter, peanut butter. I used to mix them all together and with some MCT oil, and I just wanted calories. I wanted it to be relatively light, some taste to it, and I needed density in my calories. So that's why I had MCT oil. I just used to add that to most things. And yeah, so that was kind of the overview anyway of my nutrition. And I was eating all the roughly 6,500 calories a day. I was eating it all, but I lost 28 kilos on the crossing, so I was still at that. I was still losing half a kilo every every day, basically.
But eating 6,000 calories is such hard work anyway.
Yeah.
It's not
when
pleasant.
It comes out of a bag.
Oh, it's just not pleasant.
I made some mistakes in my I made loads of mistakes in my preparation, but one of the ones that I had meant to do in the islands, we were in La Gomera 2 weeks before we were to take off, and I said out there I'd get a load of like condiments, you know, like obviously salt, pepper, hot sauce, and I just forgot in the kind of maelstrom of it all. And it was so regrettable because that food becomes incredibly bland after a while, you know, the food out of a bag. Even though I did bring quite a variety of stuff, it's still, you're pulling out, like you separate them all into days. So at day one to day 90, and you just pull out the bag and everything's in it, snacks and everything. And I'd be pulling them out and then looking in and be going, yeah, not today. Push them back in, pull out another one, you know, just anything to get something. Something different, a different taste, or there was just some meals I brought that I couldn't stomach after the first time I tried them, you know. It was never happening again. So
I can imagine you're probably day 20 and day one's happened. I think with the third podcast you're into now, Deep Roots is called, I think we're on today like 9 or something.
Five. No, day 9 is a good one. Wait for day 9. That's a good one. Especially if you're into mental health, because I was proper self-pity, self-loading that day from a mistake I made. And yeah, so day 9.
We go into that a bit.
Okay, yeah, sure. So I was... So basically day 9 or day 8, there was a big storm, and I woke up on the morning of day 9 and I went to get ready. So basically my routine was crawl out of the cabin, put on my trainers that I'd left out there, sit into my seat, clip in, you know, just make sure everything's ready. So grab my left oar, take it out of its holder, put it in the water, grab my right oar. I went to grab my right oar and there was nothing there. My hand came back to me where I should have hit the oar. And I look down and I see just the button of the oar, which is a kind of, what would you call it? A lock that goes around the oar. It's a circular thing that would have been in the middle, down the shaft of the oar. It's just hanging on to its holder. And for about 3 or 4 days prior to that, I had noticed that and this had happened in my training as well, that when I was rowing, because I'm right-handed and I put quite a bit of power through the oars, that the oar, that button was creeping up the oar shaft. And for the first few times I noticed that I would go in, take out the toolbox, grab the screwdriver, take off the nut either side, and then push it back down to the place it should be, because that's really important. It should be a certain place on the oar, you know, for you to make the most out of each stroke. And then screw it back up, and it's quite a rigmarole. And then after I just got lazy, and I started to realize I could do is just grab a hammer and knock it back into place. And that laziness ended up costing me, because during the storm, because the boat took such a kicking that the oar had just wiggled its way loose out of the button and slid off into the Atlantic, and it's still out there now to this day, I'm sure, floating around somewhere. And that just threw me, because of the stress of the circumstances and the environment I was living in, that just threw me into this fucking deep well of self-pity and self-loading, and oh, why is it, you know, woe's me, why is it so hard? I had a spare set of oars, but I didn't like them. I'd never really used them in my training. I didn't like the look of them. I didn't want to row the boat with them. The pair I had was the ones I'd used all the time and I liked, and now I couldn't use them. So I spent about 24 hours kicking the shit out of myself, you know, just looking for every fucking negative I could find, and then dwelling on it and accentuating it. And it wasn't until I did some really honest, deep reflection and looked all the way back into my training and into the last few months that I could see that I had been getting lazy in everything I did, and my standards had started to slip. And that was what was driving me into this place, you know, that I was angry with myself that I didn't change those standards. And when I had an opportunity, and now it had cost me my fucking oar. And it was just taking ownership of that, having obviously, asking myself some hard questions, finding, tracing back a pathway of actions to the kind of instigating thing, like even though it was months beforehand. What I was pissed off about was my own failure to cut that and reset my actions or raise up my actions and my standards to what I tell myself they are, to the story that I tell myself inside. And there was that disconnect was there, and I knew it was there. I felt it on some level, but I didn't have the courage to brace it or to embrace it or to look it in the face. And that's kind of where I had that. That was that whole 24 hours. But I was just taking ownership of that then and admitting it to myself and my state. Once I did that, my state just changed completely. Like once I took responsibility for my own actions.
Can I just quickly ask you, I speak to a lot of people who say they had to dig really deep inside. And I think it's something which is spoken about both in mental health, but both in extreme endurance challenges. It's something which is spoken about with self-improvement and how people look at their life, their purpose, their why, like what the fuck are they doing? It's also something that's incredibly difficult to do and is slightly counterintuitive. What does it mean for you when you say I go really deep, and how do you do it?
I don't know if I've ever ushered those words. What I've noticed is that insights come to me when I push myself physically. Like I don't know if this is true, but I think the body has so much stored in its being, you know, in its nearly in its intuition. And I find when I really push myself hard physically, I get a lot of information back about myself. And because I'm so driven, like I would say my purpose is to realize my life and to have experience the best life possible through Damien Brown. I'm so driven by that and becoming constantly improving and constantly getting better. Like that feeds me so much energy because I have that intention. When I get this information, I always use it positively to get better, you know, and I think that's where it comes from. It comes from pushing myself. So it's kind of, it's a really positive circular loop, you know, that the purpose is pushing me, but I'm also been pushed by the purpose, you know. That makes sense.
Sure, yeah, it does. Yeah, and I've got a load of, I suppose, questions or things I want to kind of challenge you on a bit later on, kind of mindset and mindfulness and a lot of stuff that I've learned from your content that you put out. But I do want to finish the row, because you're out there for 63 days. What was the worst points, bar obviously day 9, day 1?
So the thing about the row is the worst points that you might imagine or the things that came to pass are probably the most memorable as well. So like on day 14, I had a double capsize within 6 hours of each other. I had my head smashed against the side of the cabin during the first capsize. I was fast asleep. And first I knew about it was getting capsized. It was when my top of this eye hit the side of the cabin. And pandemonium would be an understatement. That day was just the craziest day of my life. So that might be well described as the worst day, but...
Sorry, what do you do when your boat capsizes in the middle of the Atlantic on your own? Like, what do you do?
So these boats are designed to self-right. So as long as the two cabin doors are fully shut. You've got two air pockets. So when the boat goes over because of the power of a wave and you've been in the wrong place on that wave, it'll either go the full 360 with the power, you know, so it'll go under. All the weight will be then on top. All the ballast, which is underneath the deck, will be on top. And then because of just physics, with the two air pockets below, it'll just flip it back over. So it'll either go 360 or 180. So thankfully, you don't have to worry about too much. You just have to worry about those fucking two cabins being fully shut every time you open or close them, because there is different levels of shut to let some air in. Like there's a, you wouldn't even think it's open, but it, water, if you were to capsize, water would rush in through that if you hadn't closed that fully. And it's easy enough to do, you know, so you just have to be really diligent in making sure that that is closed every time you come out of it. And then you just tie yourself to the boat, like, so you're tethered to the boat. You should be tethered to the boat every single time you are on deck. So I wore a climbing harness around my waist with the, I cut the legs off it. And then from that, I was clipped in with a three-way line into a thing called the jack stay, which is a really heavy duty, strong line down the side of the boat. So, you know, if and when you are capsized, you always have one point of contact with the boat, because if you are separated, you are in big, big shit. So, yeah, so I no death wish. I take on these challenges, these adventures to explore myself and explore life as well as I can do it and to the edges of it. So I don't want to not come back. So I mean, literally the second I went outside that cabin, every time I clipped in, you know, I was very careful and with that.
And those awful moments, well, I wouldn't, maybe not describe them as awful. They're incredible challenges, being capsized twice in one day.
Yes. That'll be another good episode for you. No, I mean, it's a crazy, crazy story, crazy day. So the first one, I smashed my head against the cabin. The second time I was outside trying to fix something on deck, and I went over and I hit the water. I went into the water hanging onto the boat with one hand. And I talk a lot about, so basically I visualized this happening. And the training, the visualization training I did actually came into fruition from the minute I hit that water, and I was able to dial into a visualization that I'd had and a sentence I'd said to myself through that visualization, which was just squeeze your grip, squeeze your grip, squeeze your grip. And I hung on to the boat for 180 degrees underwater as it self-righted, hanging on, one hand outstretched like that, just in this state of absolute calmness, concentrating on that one thing I needed to concentrate to save my life, which was just my grip not getting separated and my hand, or me not getting separated from the boat. And that's,
well, you so presumably you weren't strapped in at that moment then?
No, I was strapped in.
Right, okay.
I was, but I'm a big believer in I can only control what I can control, right? So I was strapped in. I had no idea what was going on with that strap. So this was all, the only thing that was in my control was my grip. So even if it had slipped, I probably had this, I had the safety net of the jack stay, but I mean, I didn't know that. So, I hoped, and I did kind of know it, but not in that moment. I wasn't thinking about it. I just let go, like, you know. So yeah, I came around and yeah.
So you've gone 180 through the water.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was like serene, like it was absolute calm. Okay, so it was a big storm outside, so it was wild, right? So obviously it's going to be much calmer underneath the water. So that was an immediate kind of sensation. But at the same time, internally, I was really calm when I should have been in absolute panic stations and chaos. I was like, and I just put that down to my mental prep beforehand and, you know, trying. So every time I go take on an adventure, sure, the question I ask myself is, what's going to stop me completing what I want to do here, achieving what I want to do? And the obvious one for me with the Atlantic row was getting separated from the boat because I can't swim. So that would have been it, you know.
As in you can't swim at all?
I can swim 20 meters and then it's sinking basically. So I'm shockingly bad at swimming. I say I can't swim. It's probably a little bit of a, I actually can't really swim, like, you know, to be honest with you. I can a few strokes and then it's like,
well, in that case, it's do or die, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So you can see, like, why this focuses the mind very much so. So I tried to visualize, well, so how am I, where would I get separated from the boat? So the obvious answer is in a capsize. Okay. Well, what's that going to look like? I don't know. But I think it's going to look like something like I'm going to see a big wave. I'm going to be rowing. I'm going to see a big wave. I'm going to drop the oars and I'm just going to grab onto a jackstay. And as long as I have my two hands grabbed onto it, as long as I have that, I'll be, I'll always have two points of contact, 1 point of contact with the boat, and I should be okay. What actually happened was a little bit different because I wasn't rowing. I was actually trying to fix the foot fucking steering that was breaking at the time. Mm. So I was actually down with my back to the where the waves are coming. And I just kind of came out of that position, out of the crouch position I was in, just to kind of, my legs were burning a little bit, you know, as you do. And as I came up, I just caught this flash of blue and white out of my right-hand corner of my eye. And I knew well it was a wave and it was pushing me over. It was coming over the top of the boat and I was going in and the boat was going over. So instinctively, I just reached behind me. I knew there was a handle on the cabin hatch behind me. I just grabbed that and I went in with that and I just hung on the whole way around until the 7 or 8 seconds it took. And I arrived, came lassoed kind of out the far side. Honestly, even to this day, and at that moment when my back hit the deck again and I was still hanging on to that handle and my legs were over my head, I was just in awe of, like, the power of that. I was able to kind of visualize that, and not only that, I was able to, that the visualization had come to help me so much in that moment, and I was so calm. I was like, holy fuck, that is just, blew me away, really. And I kind of huge proponent of using it in mental prep for anything that people are doing, like sport or adventures or whatever.
What's it like being at sea on your own for 63 days?
I found this. So I'm good in my own company. Like, I've always liked my own company. Well, not always, but I suppose I've grown to like and respect and love my own company. So for me, that was never going to be an issue. When I was running up to that Atlantic row, like, a couple of the questions I would get, that would always be one of them. Like, you're going to be on your own. You're not going to be lonely. And I don't know any way really to answer that, but just say I was never worried about it because I'm very comfortable with myself. At the same time, it's a bit of a roller coaster. You know, you have highs, but you have deep lows as well, like, because it's so stressful physically. So if I go back to one of your last questions about what's the worst thing that happened, I had sea sores, pressure sores on my arse, and fuck me, were they hard to deal with mentally. Like, it was a discomfort. The odd time it was painful, but when you're sitting on those for 11, 12 hours a day, and you know they're just getting worse every second you sit on them, and they're constantly chipping away at you, going, I'm uncomfortable, this is uncomfortable. And you've got 1,000 miles to go. You go into some deep, deep lows, like, you know. So it's just been able to revert out of those, you know, get away from that outcome orientation that your mind will go to and just bring yourself back to the present moment. But it's easier said than done. It's really, really hard. It's an absolute battle, you know, and you need a lot of things going your way. You know, it needs to mean a lot to you to get through those moments.
It's some story. I want to move on to mindset. Because I think since you wrote The Atlantic, I might be doing you a slight disservice here, but your growing following of people have seen you explore your mindset and explore the power of mindset through your social media and through... You've got a business which is Black... remind me what it is.
17 Black.
17 Black, yeah.
Yeah, no, very early days with that, but we do have big plans. Well, I do have big plans for that. And it is all around, mental strength and resilience and mindset and, yeah, all that sort of stuff, yeah. So I suppose these last few years have just helped me articulate what I've done for quite a while. But, you know, it's just over the time and the constant constant push back to those areas, I've been able to kind of put a bit more shape on it. And I read a little bit about this stuff as well, you know, so trying to learn a little bit more around the kind of workings of it all. So it does really interest me. I'm absolutely fascinated by it.
You describe living in the moment, which is actually pretty vital for, I think, as I've experienced it, overcoming anxiety, depression, and the power of mental health. But living in the moment, the slower, calmer, and peaceful life seems to be. Can you expand on that a bit further?
So I've noticed that I have rewired my mind through the physical, through body first, you know. So, and it's all come through physical endeavors and pushing into those places and learning from what they throw up, the insights, and then with the intention to improve and try and get better and get better and get better. And as this journey has gone, I've just seen that my mind has kind of nearly rewired itself in that it can only control the moment it's in. And if we don't have control, we're missing a huge piece in the puzzle of power, you know. So it's those present moment, that's all I can control. And that's what I've learned through all these endeavors, be they competing on the air, be they rugby, be they the Marathon of Sabla or the Atlantic Row, is that I can't do anything about 10 seconds from now. Like, I can't do anything until I'm in that moment. The indoor rower is the best example of this, and that's why it's my go-to, and that's why I really try and explore myself on it, because you have instant feedback right from the screen. So you learn that it's only in those, like, so if you've got a 1,000 meter row and it's flat out and you're right on the edge for that 1,000 meters, or for at least about 750 of them anyway, the first 250 will probably go by before you know it, but after that it's mentally incredibly stressful, and your body will just, because you're treading that physical line, your body just want to find a way out, but it can get through it if you have the mentality to do that. And it's just about staying in the moment and concentrating on what's in your control in those moments. And once you bring your awareness to those things that are in your control, you can always find more. So just from doing that, spending a volume of time in that, I've learned that, I think Eckhart Tolle calls it the power of now, like that. It's just, that's all you can control. And the minute we get away from that is the minute we become stressed. So like, or become anxious. If you're living in the future, you become stressed. If you're living in the past, you become a bit anxious. So yeah, I think, no, this is, it sounds a bit flowery, but
it's very interesting, because I've spoken to, again, a lot of people who explore this quite deeply. And for me, it seems like the ability to slow down and live a slightly more simpler lifestyle You talk about how that breeds gratitude, perspective, and introspection, and essentially being able to like challenge your inner being. Like, well, why does that drive you so much?
I think it's the rewards. You know, I feel better about myself. I feel those rewards are very, it's almost like there's a positive connotation to them, like that it screams out to you, this is right, do more of this, on a really deep, because that can be that deciphering between the shallow, this is good for you, like the instant gratification, and the deep one is difficult. But if you've never touched on either of them, or if you've only ever touched on the shallow instant gratification, and you don't know what the deep one feels like, you can't thirst for more of it. You can't recognize it when it comes up. And I think that's where I have a very good internal compass, in that it leads me to those rewards, the deep, fulfilling rewards. And I'm able to, just over the years, I've been able to kind of step more towards them and step away from the easier one that comes up much more often, the easy path, you know. And once that behavior has been reinforced, you almost become addicted to it, because it feels so good. It feels so fucking good when you touch on it. You're like, oh yeah, I want more of that. That is right. That is for me. That is, So I hope that answers your question.
It does. Yeah. It's so interesting. I guess you also talk about this chase for the deeper world, and a lot of people won't have ever experienced that sort of deeper world. I think me included live. I've been able to, through exploration and meditation, but also I think just sitting here and forcing myself to be like, what the fuck do I want from life, have scratched the surface. And there's a certain type and level of people who go much deeper and deeper, almost touching on spirituality. And like you said, it's the opposite of instant gratification. Why do you think we always chase instant gratification? And it's almost like this, the deeper world is a very utopian place that not many of us seem to get to.
I think because, and it comes back to a point I hit on earlier, is because it's easy. And we want easy. We're wired in our first... Now, I'm not a neuroscientist, but what I believe from my own experience of life is I am wired to look for easy first, but I have to find the way past that. And when I understand that hard has these incredible deep rewards or benefits, that is a good driver for me. And like, that's been a hard road, and it's not been easy, and there's been plenty of ups and downs and plenty of hard learnings and failures. But I think I've rebounded and come back harder at it again and again, because, you know, once you've touched on that feeling, you know, that deep, like, the best thing that's coming up for me is it's a voice that is shouting at you internally, going, yes, give me more of this. This is right. This is you. This is it. This is it. And once you've touched on that, it's hard not to look for it, and hard not to keep striving for it and keep going after it, because it feels so fucking right. But yeah, we're wired to first and foremost get past that first level thinking, is that comfort, easy, survive. But like that, I don't have a very good association with that. I have never got anywhere near that feeling I just talked about, by comfort, by easy, by the instant gratification. I've got, you know, plenty of instant gratification that I've taken in my life, and it never given me anywhere near. It's been this fleeting peak, and then it's been gone. Whereas the other one, the through the hard, through the deep reward, is it resonates on this low pulse of yes, yes, keep doing this. It's almost like it. Whatever you're doing to get there is increasing you as a person, growing you, you know, deepening you, increasing your self-belief, your self-worth, your self-esteem, your self-confidence.
Unbelievable. You've said in the past, and again, I've really gone deep on the nausing of Damien Brown, but that's what I like with these sort of things. Yeah. You've said in the past, maybe I'll be the type of person that's never satisfied with what he's achieved. Do you think there's a difference between being satisfied with an achievement like completing the Marathon des Sables or rowing the Atlantic versus life achievement?
I think so, yeah. I don't want to have any regrets at the end. You know, I know I've said in the past that death is a driver for me, like, because it's coming. The reality is it's coming, and one day you're going to be faced with yourself and your deathbed, and I just want to look back and go, fuck me, I tried. You know, I really gave it my all. I never gave up. You know, it's just too easy. I see too many people giving up in life, you know, giving up the fight. And life is a bit of a fight. It's a fucking beautiful fight, but it's a fight. Every day is a fight. And I just want to be that person that at the end just goes, you know what, I didn't fucking give up anyway. I tried. You can even see it makes me a bit emotional now talking about it. And, you know, that emotion, you can see there where I get my energy, my drive every day to get up and go after hard, like, because that's what it means, you know. And I think you will do your own head in. What I've seen from myself, I'll do my own head in along the way, like, because some things will never be enough, like, but I'll get to the end. And, I live quite satisfactory. I live quite contently. I true those rewards, but sometimes you just always be looking for more, because you're after that. You're always after something deeper or better, or want to try and go after it at least, you know. And sometimes you'll fail, but you'll come back at it again. So I think there is a difference. Yeah.
You've also described how your pain, like the way you feel pain, is your meditation, which again is a very counterintuitive.
Meditation, right?
Yeah, like explain that, because that I kind of get it, but I don't.
It might be a bit unfair to lump meditation in with physical training, but you know, I've done both. Now I've done a lot more physical training than I have done meditation, but both of them are altered states of mind. And for me, when I am really like pushing in a kind of more like some sort of intense conditioning session, my mind just goes into these places, like, and I'm always surprised the insights it throws up for me, you know, like only when I'm in those places, like there's all sorts of realizations about myself, about life. And sometimes there's nothing, sometimes there isn't, but sometimes there is. Don't ask me why. And I find that with meditation as well, like that you go into an altered state, you think a little bit differently. It's a very nice state. I love it, but I much prefer the one through the body. I don't know if the body has like own secrets locked in it or what, but why, you know, I'm not great on the neurochemistry side of things, but fuck me, I've learned that that is good for me, and that's the way I do it best, what I love. And I just keep kind of exploring that then and going after it and trying to go deeper in it.
Very interesting. This is obviously a podcast on mental health, but with you, it was too hard to resist not to speak to you anyway about the mindset, which I think can go some way to exploring better mental health. Like with depression and anxiety, I'm sure it's touched you in some way. Mental health has touched you in some way, whether it's battles yourself or people that you know. Like, how do you look at these? Like, how do you look at depression, anxiety?
Probably, like, how do I look at them? Like, I haven't had a huge, so when I was in my teens, like, these words, even though we were, as a teen, looking back, I would say I had a lot of mental health issues. The conversation wasn't there, you know, it wasn't so prevalent. But at the same time, I think we all have it within ourselves to overcome certain levels of, you know, depression and anxiety outside of probably, you know, high-end mental illness stuff, you know. I think that there's so much power within us all. I think, you know, our mind is just not wired for modern life. And we get a lot of our issues from the society we've built and what has been thrown at us all the time, the constant information, you know. So I think having tools in your life that bring you back to the present moment and push you and challenge you are really important. And that's anytime I find myself a little bit out of skew somewhere mentally, I know that I have these actions I can take to kind of reset myself and get back on track, you know. So the two main ones, the first one. So yeah. The first one is obviously training, you know, and I'm talking about a certain type of training where I really have to dig in and go hard and get through it and challenges me mentally. And that has become quite, you know, over the years, I've gravitated away from, like, I would never really go into the gym now just to do a strength session as such, because I don't get a huge mental challenge. I need to be challenged mentally to get the feeling I'm after, you know, that rewarding feeling after the session that I persevered through that. I got through it. Feels fucking great. The second one is cold water immersion. So getting into the ocean. I live on the coast here, so I'm lucky enough to have it, but I mean, it can be anything, can be, ice baths, it can be cold swim pools, you know, it can be lake, it can be river. But there's something about the ocean for me is just, I don't know, it just feels fucking great. So, you know, with the water, I'll go in now all winter and it gets down to, well, it could get down to about 5 degrees on the coldest days, which is very challenging mentally. But it's the same thing. You walk up to it and you're fucking, every cell in your body is like, no, 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 no. But then you do it, your mind, you find a way, you do it, you get out and you're fucking buzzing for the day. You're walking on a cloud. And I find that very good for the mind above anything else. It's just, it's the challenge of it, but also there's something deeper there with the cold water, in particular the ocean, that it just, it feeds back really positively.
Fascinating. I have five questions that I ask everybody who comes on. So I thought I'd definitely ask them with you, obviously. So yeah, you obviously didn't know about this either, which is good. No. Number one, what's your favorite book and why?
I love a book called Unbeatable Mind by Mark Divine. He's a former Navy SEAL, and he wrote a book, wrote a few books now at this point. But that's often one that I wish I had when I was starting out rugby. You know, I would say a lot of the reason I have really delved into mental strength was because I wasn't very good at it in rugby. I wasn't particularly mentally strong. I was inconsistent. Some days I could be the strongest and other days I just didn't want to know about it. So I am just wired to always be trying to get better. So I think that in the pursuit of getting better at that, I found a lot of rewards internally, you know. So I wish I had that book to kind of give me some processes around mental strength while I was starting rugby, so I could have been a bit more consistent. I think I would have probably achieved higher honors, if you want. But yeah, I really enjoy that book.
Interesting. I've got to look at that one. Number two, what lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
What lesson have I learned in my life that I know is true, but kind of hate? I'm not sure. Do you ever get people stuck on these questions?
Yeah. Yeah, this one's a big one, actually. Yeah.
When you were reading out that question, I thought I was going to talk about gut, you know. But no, I don't hate that. That's for sure. You stumped me. I probably about a week from now I'll be sitting down going, I should have said that. For fuck's sake, why didn't you say that?
Why don't we come? I'll come back to it. Give it.
Yeah.
I actually want to ask that one. Your friend who's having a tough time at the moment picks up the phone, rings you, and says he's having a really bad day today. What do you say?
How can I help? I would try and figure out. So I'm a big details person. So I hate dealing in kind of generalities or broad things. I found that outside of the rugby environment, the people generally ironic, but it's kind of a symptom of society that we talk in these generalities, but I need to know details. Like if you want to make it better, I need to know the exact details, and then I could probably figure out or pinpoint or advise accordingly, you know? So that's what I found with myself. Like if you even think back to when I talked about losing the oar, like, you know, it was all about tracing back to the root details of what went wrong and then taking responsibility for that. So I'd be looking for, you know, I'd be trying to figure out what he or she what had bothered them, and then trying to kind of get down to the roots of that, and then hopefully advise them, you know. Part of that, then I'd go tell them to go jump in the sea. And tell me, I bet you it'll be better afterwards.
that's a good one. Number four, actually, I've adapted this question because I think we answered it earlier inadvertently. But what do you think we can learn from dogs?
Patience. I am a huge dog lover. I would say my own dog Elmo has changed my life in bringing him in and seeing myself and my behaviors reflected through how I treat him, and almost, you know, learning through that experience. Like, you know, their unconditional love, their patience, their lack of cynicism, their spirit, his spirit. I love him. I love dogs so much.
Likewise.
Just such a beautiful thing to have in your life, to have that connection and friendship and you know, no matter how shit a day you're having, come in and the sight of the wagon tail and you're just, your spirit is lifted, you know, and yeah.
Nice.
I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does. I love that. Yeah. That's a question I haven't actually asked anybody before, but I just came up with it because obviously I know how much you love dogs, your social media, and it's in your WhatsApp picture as well. And I was like, this would be a great one to ask. Number five, and this is going to be an interesting one. You're lying on your deathbed looking back at your life. What are you most proud of?
Kind of touched on it already, I think.
Yeah.
It won't be any one thing. I feel I'm actually in expect father that could change in the next 5 months when I hold my daughter for the first time. First time father, by the way.
Wow, so, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah. So that maybe that'll change 5 months from now when I have that experience. But I think, you know, it'll just be around striving and trying. And I know people use this expression all the time, but I really feel that there's too much of it, and it's just not giving up, like, you know, not settling. Just fucking keep trying for more for myself, trying to eke out more of my life, and trying to make my experience of my life a little bit better and those around me. I'm a huge believer in if you're continually lifting yourself up, everyone else around you benefits. I like to think of it like if you place a tissue on the table and you're in the middle of it, and your friends are in one corner, your partner's in the other corner, your family's in the other corner, and your colleagues or whatever in the other corner of the tissue, and you're in the middle and you're lifting yourself up and lifting yourself up and lifting yourself, everyone else lifts with you, everybody else comes with you, you know. So I think if I am that person and I continually strive to be a better person and realize my life as best I can, that will be a life well lived.
Mm. Have you thought about the second one? What lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true, you kind of hate?
Could be here a while.
That's all right. I can edit.
I'm feeling a lot of pressure all of a sudden.
That's good. I'm taking you out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it might be a bit of silence here. I hope this isn't like radio where they say dead air is. Let me think.
I could play a commercial ad in this.
So say the question is, what lesson have I learned in my life that I know is true, but I hate?
Yeah.
But I hate the ants. They hate the fact that it's true, is it?
Mm.
Yeah. I got it. I got one.
Where did you go just then? Where did you go just then? In fact, sorry.
Internal turmoil, man. I was like, fuck. Why is my brain not? I can't go up with anything. Actually, this isn't a lesson. This is, shite.
No, just say really it anyway. Say it. It's going to be interesting anyway, knowing you.
Well, it was more along, I was just thinking about the dogs thing, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I hate the fact that we outlive dogs by whatever it is, probably 8-9-folds, you know. Because honestly, my dog's a little bit sick at the moment, so.
Oh no. How old is that one?
He's 11.
Mm.
So it's been pretty tough watching him, you know. So I hate that fact. That, like, I mean, that we're, when we lose a dog, we lose this spirit, you know, this like love, this it's unfair, I find, that they pass they spend less time on the planet than we do, because like we could all benefit from a little bit of the spirit that a dog has, you know, would make us a better person, and we lose that when they go. So I hate that fact, even though it's not, I understand it's not a lesson as well. It kind of is a lesson, right?
I really like that. I agree. I've got two dogs. They both live at my one's mine, she's a collie, and she's three and she's mental. She lives with my parents, because she would just tear my flat apart. But another dog called Viva, and she's a Labrador collie cross, and she's 14, and she's doing well for 14. She's killing it. But the love and the love and the care and the attention and the positivity always is
it's extraordinary. I think we can learn the most in our lives from dogs, actually. That's what I truly believe. I think you take the values from a dog and you put it into your life, and there you just that's that you can take those value sets wherever you go.
I like that.
I want you to quickly talk. I'm just conscious of time, Damien. It's almost 2 o'clock, but for a few minutes, talk about what you're about to embark on soon. Is it Project 2022, right?
Yeah. So, I have a crazy couple of years ahead of me, or less than a couple of years. So I got Mount Everest, obviously, for next year. But the year after that, April, May 2022, me and a good friend of mine, his name is Gussie Farrell, we're going to attempt to row from New York to Galway. So we're both from Galway on the west coast of Ireland. So we want to row into our hometown. So there's a couple of ways you can cross the Atlantic. I've already done the kind of more southerly northern route, if that makes any sense. So in the northern hemisphere, but along, so from the Canaries to, you can go to South America or the Caribbean. There is a lot of help by Mother Nature on that route. So you have the trade winds and you have the currents, basically, all moving, to the west, east to west. But on the much more northerly route that you can actually also cross the Atlantic as a rowboat or sailboat is the you can either go from Canada or kind of New York, Boston area to Northern Europe. You could go to the UK, you could go to Ireland, you could go to France. There's a lot less help up there, like there's no real winds. It's quite localized weather. There is winds, but they're all localized and doing different things. So you don't have that consistency of the trade winds you have in the south. Now you do have the Gulf Stream, which is this big current that sweeps up along the coast of North America and across the Northern Atlantic. But it's a different kettle of fish. So it's fucking cold and it's unforgiving as a route, you know. Even getting away from New York is really difficult because of tides and because of the amount of time you have to spend near the coast. And then you have much more obstacles along the way. So not just adding in the cold, the lack of winds, but you've got these things called eddies, which are giant whirlpools. So you can get stuck in them for like a week, 10 days, you know, until it spits you out. You can be going around in a circle. And then I haven't even mentioned that the fucking 3,000 miles you have to row, the storms, the possibility of hurricanes. It's possibly one of the hardest challenges on the planet. You know, it's a different kettle of fish. So, that's what we're going to do.
You also haven't mentioned Gussie's injury, is one of the most extraordinary things I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, Gussie's had a like crazy couple of years in terms of his physical breakdown. Like, so he was fully functioning, was in his yard. He owns a bus company. He was in his yard one day and picked up this, as he describes himself, this light bench, and just felt this like pop in his lower back. And Gussie being Gussie, he went at it again. He was getting a help from one of his drivers. The next time he went down to pick it up, he just said this explosion of pain in his back that he, as he described himself, his, what did he say? It was, he called it something. He says indescribable. That's what he said. Indescribable pain. And then, so basically he was rushed into our local hospital in Galway, and then he was driven up to Dublin and he had an emergency surgery and was basically given 5% chance to ever walk again by the surgeon when he came out of that. But speaking of not giving up, he definitely didn't give up. And 6 weeks after that surgery, he got the first twitch in his big toe on his right-hand side, and he said he'd been kind of concentrating on that. And funnily enough, they say, not funnily enough, but they say that, like, if you don't get any sensation back after the first week or two after surgery, you can just forget about it. It's not coming back, you know. But 6 weeks after it, he actually got the big toe twitch. And since then, he's just had this miraculous kind of recovery to the fact that he went into a rehab hospital, came out 12 weeks later, walked out the door 12 weeks later, and then a year after the accident, walked from where it happened back to the hospital 206 kilometers across the country in 5 days. And yeah, so amazing, amazing story. And he's going to be on the boat with me, you know. We've been friends since we were like 16, 17. So
how's that going to work with his injury?
It should be okay. We don't really see massive complications. Like he has the one issue I'd be worried about. So he shouldn't have any issue rowing. He can row on an ergometer. He rowed a traditional Irish boat called the Curragh with me. No issues. He did really well, actually. The only issue is the movement. He's not doesn't have great proprioception, you know. So, you know, where you and I know our foot is going to hit the ground, he really doesn't, you know. And even a fraction of an inch here and there, and that can be quite destabilizing. So you see that in a little bit in the way he walks, even though he's come a huge way. So we're just a little bit, I'd be a little bit concerned anyway about the boat and moving around the boat, and just been really, really, really fucking careful, because, you know, half the time you kind of spend in a crouch in the boat because you feel like it's going to just get, you're going to get knocked off it, you know. So changeovers and that, we'll have to train them and be really slick and be really have good teamwork around that. So yeah, it's all ahead of us in a way, but we feel like there's nothing that's gonna really stop him from rowing across, or trying to anyway, at least. Yeah,
extraordinary. I put your Instagram, your social media tags, you know how this works, and and all of the Project 2022 stuff in the show notes, so people can click through and have a look.
Superb.
Forward. I cannot thank you enough for what an extraordinary podcast that was. One of my favorites I've ever done. So thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. I loved it. Yeah, it was a great conversation. You stumped me with that question as well. Fair enough.
I'm good. I'm going to take that away with me.
Yeah.
Damien, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, James. Cheers.